Lecture 4, Lafayette, La Princesse de Clèves, Part 1.
In this lecture and the next, we'll take up a pioneering novel, La Princesse de Clèves, which was written when realistic narratives about people in their everyday lives were just beginning to appear. As it happens, it was published in 1678, the very same year as that very otherworldly book, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. First, though, it's important to understand the worldview of the French court culture that this novel describes. And for that, we have a wonderful guide in the Maxims of the Duke de la Rochefoucauld. The 17th century was a time of unrest all over Europe. England had its civil war. France, too, had the threat of one, though it was successfully put down. La Rochefoucauld was no armchair observer of life. He had an impressive military career and was seriously wounded on 3 separate occasions. In the middle of the 17th century, France was torn by a series of revolts known as La Fronde, which means the slingshot. The nobility were trying, unsuccessfully as it turned out, to resist the centralized power being established by the government under Cardinal Mazarin, who was chief minister of the then boy king, Louis XIV. La Rochefoucauld took an active role in these revolts, and he paid for it with very insecure standing at court later on. But in 1660, nevertheless, he settled in Paris and began to write his Maxims, which were first published in 1664, and then afterwards in a series of progressively enlarged editions. Among his close friends was Madame de Lafayette, who may also have been his lover, and he contributed advice on the manuscript of La Princesse de Clèves, so we can be sure there's a close affinity between her novel and his Maxims. These Maxims are a loosely organized collection of hundreds of condensed aphorisms on life. They express the unsentimental view of a realist who, like Hobbes and Halifax, sees selfishness and duplicity as the normal characteristics of human beings. Like many others who lived through that period of scary political unrest, La Rochefoucauld and his contemporaries were displacing aggressive energies into stylized forms. Louis XIV built his gargantuan palace at Versailles to get the nobility out of their provincial power centers and let them compete for empty honors at court. Unlike in England, by the way, French aristocrats had a code of not making money, and he controlled them by encouraging a spendthrift lifestyle and then tying them up with huge loans. So what we get is intense competition for prestige at court and in the coterie world of witty salons, which were presided over by talented women, including Madame de Lafayette. This was an extremely worldly culture. In fact, the name for it is mundanité, worldliness. And in this exclusive world, La Rochefoucauld was admired as an example of the ideal of the honnête homme, loosely translated gentleman, highly skilled in the art of living. Social graces and tact, good taste, intelligence, skill at conversation, those were the ideal. In this intellectual world, it was the age of the great French moralists. And what that meant was not morality in a narrow sense, but human behavior in all its aspects. It was an important stage in the evolution of what we now call psychology. By the way, psychology was originally a religious term. In Greek, the word psyche means soul. It was the science of the soul. The word doesn't appear in its modern sense, meaning studying the mind and emotions, until about 1750. Well, the characteristic shape of a maxim by La Rochefoucauld is to say X is really Y, or even X is only Y, as in a very well-known example, hypocrisy is the homage that vice pays to virtue. It might seem like cynical debunking, but it's really more than that. It's a question of accurate analysis that breaks down oversimplifications. What the aphorism says is not virtue doesn't exist, but virtue is complicated and it overlaps with other things, and much of what passes for virtue is really hypocrisy covering its tracks. Despite their brilliance, these maxims end up seeming strangely repetitive. The great modern critic Roland Barthes said, When you read a few of them, you think how amazingly true, how modern this guy is. But if you read a lot of them in bulk, they develop a wearying sameness. It's a blinkered vision of a highly privileged milieu that produced them. One scholar has called the maxims of La Rochefoucauld the autopsy of a dying class. And for all their intellectual clarity, they have certain built-in limitations from the point of view of contributing to the development of psychology. And I'd like to stress three of these limitations as a prelude to the impressive advance that Madame de Lafayette made in La Princesse de Clèves. The first point is they're non-narrative. They use present tense verbs, usually is, to crystallize what is always the case in human behavior, without, of course, recognizing how much it's bound to a particular class in a particular time and place. Secondly, they don't add up to a connected picture. They're fragmentary. Sometimes they're contradictory. And because they don't lead anywhere, each maxim is like a short circuit trapped in itself. Thirdly, there's no overt author. They're like proverbs, the distillation of universal truths. There's no sense of personality with an individual history, no indication of the subjectivity of the person who's telling you all this. The whole point is to make the maxims so general they can be universal, and everyone can say, yes, it's true. That's what it's always like. That's why La Rochefoucauld says in one of the maxims, it's easier to know man in general than to know a particular man. The basic premise of these maxims, just like Pascal's pensée, is that self-love, in French, amour propre, is the single key to everything we do. But whereas Pascal diagnosed this blindness to our own selves as the sin of pride, La Rochefoucauld is an entirely secular writer. For him, pride isn't a sin, it's just a fact. And because he doesn't have the answer the way Pascal did, La Rochefoucauld is remarkably open to a kind of insight that was very rare in his time, and much later for that matter. He sometimes does talk about the inner life of the self in ways that almost anticipate modern theories of the unconscious. Listen to what he says in this maxim. It's actually not one of the brief aphorisms. It's more like a little essay. It's a long quote, but it's well worth reading in full. Amour propre is love of oneself and of all things for oneself. It makes men idolaters of themselves and makes them tyrants over others if fortune gives them the means to be. Pascal, you know, said exactly the same thing about being tyrants over others. But La Rochefoucauld goes on to talk about self-love in a really new way. One cannot sound the depths or pierce the shadows of its abysses. There, it's often invisible to itself. It conceives, nourishes, and rears affections and hatreds without knowing it. It forms one so monstrous that after it's brought them to light, it doesn't recognize them or can't bring itself to acknowledge them. You see what I mean? That sounds a lot like Freud's theory of the unconscious, a dark interior that our conscious ego can never penetrate. And that's because, Freud would say, it generates repressed desires that the ego can't afford to know about. Rochefoucauld isn't done. He goes on. It is, that is, self-love is, in every stage of life, in all conditions of life, it lives everywhere. It lives on everything. It lives on nothing. It even enters into alliance with people who make war against it. It hates itself with them. It even works toward its own ruin. In the end, it cares only that it exists. And provided that it does exist, it's quite willing to be its own enemy. You may well be thinking about Pascal here. Pascal tells us to hate ourselves, but even in saying that, he's asserting himself. In one of the pensées, Pascal admits he can't help feeling proud of the eloquence with which he denounces pride. And so now, at the end of this very searching maxim, comes the most remarkable statement of all. The sea is a tangible image of it. Amour propre finds in the ebb and flow of its continual waves a faithful expression of the turbulent succession of its thoughts and of their eternal motion. Remember that the classical model of the self, which was taken over by Christianity, postulated a stable hierarchy, reason on top, the passions below, the will carrying out the commands of reason. What La Rochefoucauld is proposing is an image of the self as endless change and flux, the very opposite of something stable and controlled. To put it differently, the outward, social self can be shaped to a great extent, producing the cultivated honnête homme like La Rochefoucauld himself. But deep down, the real energies of the self are not controllable or even knowable at all. Now, as we'll see later on, 18th century writers like Hume and Diderot, half a century later than La Rochefoucauld, will arrive at quite similar ideas about the self in endless flux. But they will do it from a very different perspective. They will be extremely reluctant to adopt the pessimistic view of human nature that La Rochefoucauld's generation accepted. In the 17th century, a lot of people got interested in the ancient philosophy of Stoicism, the doctrine that willpower can subdue the passions. People who lived through political unrest were tempted to seek stability and peace in an inner retreat. But La Rochefoucauld and his circle were deeply skeptical about that. Like Pascal and the Jansenists, they believed the passions were far more powerful than the mind, which invents rationalizations to make itself feel better. The maxims of La Rochefoucauld had a frontispiece with a bust of the ancient Stoic philosopher Seneca with an impassive expression. But the picture also shows that a cherub has stripped away his mask and his real face is tortured with suffering. Now, if we turn from these maxims to La Princesse de Clèves, we see at least one huge difference right away. It's a connected narrative. It follows characters in temporal experience, which is something the maxims refuse to do. It's even a sort of historical novel because it's set in the much earlier court of Henri II, a full century before the novel was written, partly probably to avoid suspicion that the characters were based on real people in the court of Louis XIV, which they may have been. So in any case, Lafayette published the book anonymously, and she concealed her authorship from everyone except her very closest friends. By the way, until quite recently, she was always referred to by her title, the Comtesse de Lafayette. Recent editions give her name as Marie-Madeleine Pioche de Lavergne. That's in keeping with our ideas of political correctness. She would have been appalled at our familiar use of her name. As for the historical setting that she uses, there was a good novelistic reason. She was looking back to a time 100 years before when the aristocracy still had plenty of real power before they dwindled into the basically decorative role they had when she wrote the novel. She was intimately familiar with the court. She spent most of her life in Paris. She had a nobleman husband who was away most of the time. She conducted a leading salon along with her friend Madame de Sévigné, whose letters later on became a classic of French literature. She wrote several other novels in addition to La Princesse de Clèves and some memoirs of the court, but this is unquestionably her masterpiece. Her novel is set at a crucial historical moment, which French readers of the time would have recognized. Just as her story ends, Henri II has died after an accident in a tournament in which he took part, and we can know in historical hindsight that it was all going to come unstuck. His queen, Catherine de' Medici, would then make an alliance with the Guise family, which was out of power in the time the novel is talking about, and that would lead to terrible civil wars, culminating in the famous St. Bartholomew's Day massacre of 1572, when out-of-control mobs roamed the streets of French towns, shooting down Protestants, and the leaders of Protestantism were murdered. In a way, this was a common theme in the old romances of chivalry that preceded modern novels, that is, the breakdown of community, as in the Arthurian stories, the Fellowship of the Round Table gets destroyed by jealousy and betrayals among the knights. But this novel was a sensation because it was not a romance in that old sense. No fairyland, no legends, no magicians and enchanters. It's interesting that Lafayette based her novel on extensive historical research. Most of her characters were real people 100 years before, except for the heroine. She's totally made up. So what we have is an unreal person inserted in a real world, but not the all-embracing real world of the later novels, say, of Dickens and Tolstoy. It's an extremely circumscribed world of privilege, with people who seem to have everything. The one thing they don't have is anonymity and privacy. It's a world of tireless gossip, everyone trying to find out everyone else's secrets, and there's a feeling of stifling claustrophobia. Here's a striking description of that court culture by a friend of Lafayette. Her name was Madame de Motteville. She says, "We're going to see the climate of this country called the court. The air here is never serene for anyone. Even those who seem to enjoy complete happiness and are adored like gods are the ones who are most threatened by storms. Those whom the others envy are always sick with the contagious malady of ambition, which destroys their peace of mind, corrodes their hearts, and gives them vapors in the head that often deprive them of their reason." The enclosed world of that court is like a microclimate, like a biosphere. In this novel, we see nothing of the rest of the world outside. There are no common people. We barely even see any servants. It's as if the court was the only reality there is. And in this society, ambition and being admired are the driving forces, just as La Rochefoucauld said. But because prestige depends on other people's responses, no one can ever be at peace. It's the most admired people who are most tormented by fears that maybe their prestige might be waning. So this is the novel into which the heroine arrives as a teenager. Her mother brings her to this court from the country because it's time to select a husband. And at this point, at the beginning of the novel, her name is Mlle de Chartres. We're never told her first name. And because she's woundingly beautiful, every man who sees her wants her. But meanwhile, she's very naive and earnest, and she doesn't even begin to understand the seduction games of the court. Now, a nobleman named the Prince de Clèves, he's not the king's son. In those days, the term prince was used more widely. The Prince de Clèves happens to see her in a shop, falls head over heels in love, goes to her mother, and persuades her to accept the match and make this girl his wife. So as the wife of a prince, she now has this title, princesse. She likes this husband, she respects him, but she doesn't conceal the fact she doesn't desire him passionately. Meanwhile, the most glamorous male in the entire court, whose name is the Duc de Nemours, he was a real person at the time, he also falls for the young beauty. And the rest of the story is her realization that the attraction is mutual, but also her firm resistance to giving in to Nemours, even after her husband is dead. To understand the psychology of this novel, and it is a psychological novel, we have to unlearn our normal response to stories about falling in love. I think you can generalize about the way love has been treated in Western culture. And you could say there's always been a tension between two ways of understanding it. On the one hand, love can be the fullest experience of authenticity, fully sharing with another person, holding nothing back. So then it's an ideal of mutuality that's an antidote to the isolated individualism of the modern world. Millions of love stories, novels and movies and TV series have followed that right up to the present day. But on the other hand, love can be felt as loss of freedom, enslavement to another person. In fact, the most painful kind of slavery, because it's voluntarily chosen, and yet it can still seem entrapping or even destructive. Now, from ancient times right up into the 17th century, that was pretty much the standard way of thinking about falling in love. That is, the sudden, overwhelming chemical response that connects you to another person. And in classical mythology, quite subtly, Venus is the goddess of sexual desire, but individual choices are controlled by her bratty son, Cupid. In Greek, his name was Eros, who fires his arrows at random. And here's one of La Rochefoucauld's maxims. "The most accurate comparison one can make of love is with a fever. We have no more power over one than the other, whether for its violence or its duration." It's as if your friend were to say, "I've fallen in love," and your appropriate response would be, "I'm really sorry." Moreover, in the old aristocratic culture, marriage was a dynastic arrangement between two families. You would hope to respect your mate, but there was no question of the violent falling in love experience leading to lifelong union with Mr. or Ms. Wright. Another writer of the time, Jean de La Bruyère, wondered whether it might be possible for a husband to be in love with his wife. He doesn't rule it out, but clearly it's something he's never encountered. So what does love amount to in this courtly biosphere? It's a code of seduction. Love is a form of power. All the more attractive for a class that's losing real power, so now it's fighting its wars in the bedroom instead of the battlefield. It follows, then, that love as mutual relationship, our modern ideal, would be a big threat to these people. Because if you're in love, you are the other person's thrall. That's an old English word meaning a slave. It's the root of our word enthralling. You've been enslaved. And you're going to be devastated when they drop you, as they certainly will. Because once the thrill of conquest is over, it'll be time to move on. So in that tradition, desire is defined as lack. You want what you don't have. If you get it, you'll immediately want something else. And it follows that in this ethos, love couldn't be giving of the self, because then you would lose your power advantage. So it's a game of flirtation and seduction in which the successful lover remains uninvolved, withholding the self. The role of the prince de Clèves, the princess's husband, is particularly interesting here. Since he's desperately in love with her, whereas she honestly admits she doesn't feel that way, he feels like he still doesn't have her. He goes on passionately desiring his wife just because she doesn't desire him. But even if she doesn't feel passionate about her husband, she does resolve to remain faithful to him. So although Nemours, this attractive other man, keeps dropping hints, she refuses to acknowledge any feelings for him. By the same principle, this drives Nemours wild. He could have practically any woman in that court, but because this one resists him, he's tormented by her. Now, it's important to understand another thing. Although the princess and Nemours are powerfully attracted to each other, they hardly know each other at all. What each one is attracted to, and the novelist makes that very clear, is the image. His social and athletic performance, her beauty and grace. And the French tradition has tended to see it this way much more, I think, than the Anglo-American one. The modern French writer Paul Valéry has a remark, "That which is real can't be desired because it's real. You desire what you've invented in your head." And here's another point. If we want what we haven't got, we're more likely to want it if someone else has it. And that's the tradition of triangular desire, which has always played a very important role in French fiction. Again, more so than the English tradition, which is more optimistic about mutual happiness. Now, Nemours is jealous of the princess's husband because he has her and Nemours doesn't. The husband is jealous, though he doesn't even know who to be jealous of, because he suspects that since she's not in love with him, she must be in love with somebody else. As for the princess, she finally realizes how strong her feelings for Nemours are at the exact moment of an attack of jealousy when someone remarks to her that they think he may be in love with still another woman. Now, on this subject, La Rochefoucauld has a particularly unsparing maxim. He says, "In jealousy, there is more of self-love than love. More of amour propre than amour." And the reason jealousy is so painful then is it's self-regarding. You're wounded in your own self-love. How can she or he do this to me? Well, we're in a good position now to start thinking about the implications of this novel for psychology, in which the aphoristic "this always happens" style of La Rochefoucauld has been translated into temporal narrative, relationships between individuals. And the subject we need to focus on is the problem of sincerity. If you look up the word sincere in a modern dictionary, you'll get a list of attributes like honest, truthful, without hypocrisy, in reality what it appears to be. Now, there could hardly be a more central topic for this entire course. Remember, the Augustinian tradition held we are literally incapable of knowing the truth about our own motives because the sin of pride constantly rationalizes what we're doing. And the secular psychology of Hobbes and La Rochefoucauld says the same thing, except it drops the idea of sin and just decides we better take people as they are. Right through the 18th century, there will continue to be versions of this same thing in writers who do stress the artificial role-playing quality of human life. But we'll also be thinking about a powerful counter-tradition, and it's one that's had an immense influence on the culture we still live in. And that's the tradition that calls for us to be true to our deepest self, get past the layers of rationalization, find out who we authentically are. In fact, we take this ideal so much for granted, we tend to read it back anachronistically into earlier times. We happen to know the motto of the ancient Greek oracle at Delphi was, "Know thyself," and we assume it means deep self-awareness. Scholars tell us it meant something much more like, "Know your place in the world, don't get above your station." Likewise, you'll hear people say, "As Shakespeare says, to thine own self be true." They forget the person who says that is the old windbag Polonius, who's telling his son Laertes to have a good public image, even if it's not the same thing as his real behavior. We also have plenty of voices today suggesting maybe the role-playing story is the right one. A modern sociologist said, "Sincerity is the illusion of somebody who's taken in by his own act." Now, this opposition between the unknowable inner self and the ideal of sincerity and the exterior social self is built into the very heart of La Princesse de Clèves. Quite early in the story, the Prince de Clèves tells his wife about a friend of his who grieved deeply when his mistress died, and then he was horrified to find out all along she'd been unfaithful to him. So this meant he was torn between two contradictory feelings, grief and jealousy, and he says he feels like he's losing his mind. The prince tells his wife, he knows you can't control who you fall in love with, but he implores her, "At least tell me the truth. If you do fall for somebody else, even if you don't sleep with them, but if you're actually, you know, bonded with them in some way, that way he won't be under the humiliating delusion about what her true feelings are." He's being quite idealistic in saying this. "Tell me the truth, I can stand it." And throughout this novel, he's presented as an outstandingly honorable good person, as the princess always acknowledges. So she agrees to do it, but her real reason is she wants to block her own temptation to respond to Namur. If her husband knows she's got these feelings, then she's that much less likely to give in. Why doesn't she want to give in? Partly it is loyalty to the idea of marriage, though of course she sees it betrayed on every side every day. More directly, it's an unwillingness to get hurt. Everything she sees confirms the account of love I've been just describing. You fall for someone, then they drop you. Then you're miserable. They've proved they had the power and you don't. But, of course, in the plot of this story, her attempt to be sincere backfires. Once she admits she is attracted to someone else, it drives her husband crazy with jealousy. He starts obsessively watching for clues for an affair that, in fact, isn't happening at all. As for Namur, the other guy, he isn't sure of her feelings and he wants to find out. Now, one day, he knows the princess is supposed to be having her portrait painted. He finds a way to be present. She's at her levee. She's in bed, but, you know, fully clothed and visible to the public. And a friend who's with her asks to compare this new portrait with a miniature version that was painted earlier. And when they put the miniature back on a table and the two women are chatting, Namur sees a chance to back up to the table and slip it in his pocket. Now, listen to the very subtle way the narrator describes what happens next. Through the partly closed curtains of her bed, Madame de Clèves noticed Monsieur de Namur, who was at the foot of the bed with his back to the table, and she saw that without turning his head, he deftly picked something up. She had no trouble guessing it was her portrait, and she was so disturbed that her friend noticed she wasn't listening and asked what she was looking at. At these words, Monsieur de Namur turned. He encountered Madame de Clèves' eyes, which were still fixed on him. And he thought it not impossible that she had seen what he just did. This is a perfect illustration of the claustrophobic world of the court. The meeting of eyes when Namur takes the portrait is very powerful. They can't speak. There's a third party there who mustn't be allowed to know what's going on. And indeed, neither one of them is quite sure what has just happened. But the princess is pretty sure he must have taken her portrait. And he's pretty sure her fixed gaze means she knows he took it and isn't stopping him. It's a symbolic appropriation of her person, and she tacitly permits it. Among other things in the story, this is evidence of Namur's high-handed erotic style. It's dangerous and selfish of him to take that portrait. It's a reminder she would do well not to give in to this man, but it's also a dramatic enactment of their interest in each other, and it's all the more intense for being covert and secretive. Now, in the next lecture, we'll follow the plot as it puts increasing pressure on these characters until the princess unexpectedly chooses the one solution that can spring her from this trap of desire leading to its own frustration and the trap of jealousy as the inevitable consequence of love.